Hi everybody, this is Marlene with Erie News, and today is April Fool's Day, April 1st, 2024, Monday, April 1st, 2024. And our first story is a historical mystery, one of my favorites out of Stranger Than Fiction stories, and it's titled The Long Island Lothario. A skeleton was discovered on October 17th, 1909, in a lonely spot in the woods 2 miles north of Islip, Long Island, by rabbit hunters. There was no flesh on the bones, which gave evidence it had lain there for a long time. They were also charred from a forest fire that occurred in the area months before. The clothing was in pieces, and the leg bones, with his shoes still on, lay about 20 feet away. One of the bones showed signs of having been chewed by some animal. The clothing was a black dress and coat, a man's black silk muffler, which was tied about the neck of the skeleton. The ribs were encased in a black silk corset. The clothing was foreign made, but of good quality. In the pocket of the coat was a bill with a postmark of Kefeld, Rhenish, Prussia. This was the only clue the authorities initially found upon discovering the remains. She had a gold neck chain with a heart-shaped locket set with diamonds, and a pendant made from a freshwater pearl. On the left wrist was also a gold chain with a pearl setting. A silver thimble, a hatpin, and several hairpins were found. The body lay near the corner of two intersecting roads, designated as Broadway and 28th Street, but they were seldom used, which accounted as to why the body lay there so long without being found. She was blonde, judging by a thick mass of ribbon-tied hair found with the skull. It was still in a bow, leading to the belief she was young. Her teeth had been filled with gold and appeared to have been well cared for. Once the word got out of the discovery, the police received different leads pertaining to women that had gone missing, but as they found out more about the victim, they were able to eliminate them. The coroner, who returned to the scene of where the skeleton was discovered, found a .32 caliber where the skull had lain. A further examination of the remains found a hole under the left ear that might have been made by a bullet. It seemed a bullet had passed through her throat, severing the esophagus and lodging inside the head, where it remained until decomposition dislodged it. This was considered a strange shot. It was suspected she was shot while in an automobile. No revolver was found at the scene, putting in doubt the theory of suicide. Near the skeleton was found an automobile veil of tan chiffon silk, catch-stitched at the edges. Robbery as a motive was discounted since the jewelry had not been taken, including a gold watch on a fleur-de-lis pin, a snake bracelet of a peculiar design, and a necklace of golden pearls. Inside the case of the watch, the initials AL had been scratched with a date 1893. Coroner Savage confirmed that the clothing she was wearing was expensive, and her black silk corset was made to order and cost $50. Later was determined that Annie Luther was given much of her expensive clothing from the rich women she had worked for through the years. The bones were taken to Daly's morgue, and in the meantime, the German consul general was brought into the case. The bill that was found in her pocket was issued in Krebel, a town of Prussia. There was also a guidebook issued by the Hamburg American Steamship Company. Within a week of the discovery, the Hamburg police cabled information that the victim was probably Anna Latter of Altona, a suburb of Hamburg. Later, this surname was corrected to Luther. The police then started hunting for Otto Mueller, who was said to have married her on February 6, 1908, in Newark, New Jersey. In the months leading up to the wedding, she had been employed as a maid in the home of Isaac Seligman, a New York banker, for 2 years. She was described as a pretty girl who worked as a maid for wealthy families in Denver, Chicago, and New York. Annie Luther had met her future husband at Far Rockaway Beach while she was caring for an invalid there. He introduced himself as an architect and said he owned 12 lots in Jamaica, Long Island, where he planned to build a house. The authorities found a witness to the wedding named Mrs. Henry Werpup. She and her husband were to become instrumental in identifying the culprit. Shortly after the wedding, Mueller took his bride to Europe, where they visited her relatives. Then they returned to New York and spent a few days in Newark visiting friends. Suddenly, the couple were lost track of, However, the mystery of their disappearance was soon forgotten. Police eventually ran down Mueller's home in Astoria. Police found Regina von Miller, who was one of Mueller's wives. She recounted how she believed her husband was in the habit of escorting women to lonely parts of Long Island for the purpose of forcing them to part with their money. She owned considerable property and was in partnership with her brother George, where they ran a barber supply business. She admitted that she believed her husband had been after her money when they married, and that he disappeared 6 months after the ceremony. She told police he got $2,200 from her while they lived together, and when she refused to give him any more, he abandoned her. He told her he was of noble birth and that he received degrees in law and medicine in Germany. Two other women informed the police they were courted by a German whose description answered that of Otto Mueller, or Van Miller, as he was also known. The police found Otto Mueller working as a grocery clerk at 681 Wythe Avenue, Brooklyn. He eventually admitted he killed Anna because he wanted to get rid of her and return to his wife. The authorities now wondered if Mueller had married different women and then murdered them as well. He was taken to the station on Mulberry Street, Manhattan, where he was given the third degree. Marie Kramer, a trained nurse, Mrs. Henry Werpup, and Mary Duckhausen, all from Newark, who were present at the wedding, positively identified him. Then Mueller recanted and said he had left Anna in a flat in Manhattan and went abroad to visit relatives, but found her gone when he returned. Police found that he had married another woman in Manhattan in February 1905 and left her with two children. Then they located another woman, also from Manhattan, who had married him, but he had deserted her after taking $2,700. During his last marriage, he was using the name Fred Gebhardt. Mrs. Gebhardt told police that after she had given birth to two children, one day a woman came to her and said, "Your husband has put seven wives in their graves. You better watch out or he will have you there." She said he had left the family in February 1908 without any money. She then received letters from Germany, and when he landed in the country, he came back to live with them. Three trunks were delivered, many which contained expensive clothing, and books inscribed with the name Anna Luther inside. Mueller burned the letters and erased the name in the books or tore out the fly leaves. The woman, who had told her that her husband had buried seven wives, said his first wife went on to marry Richard Mincer, who was Gebhardt's partner in real estate business. This was Gebhardt's confession. "About December 1907, I first met Anna Luther. We were married in February 1908 and went to Europe to live. We returned April 6, 1908. She went to Henry Werpup's in New York, New Jersey, to spend a day or two. On the pretense that I was going to rent an apartment for us to live, I returned to my home and wife in Astoria. I met Anna again on April 1st in New York, and we went to an address in 34th Street, New York, and then to Jamaica, Long Island, where we stayed until the next day. On April 9th, we went to Bayshore, and we walked about, and I showed her some property. I got into an argument with her about some money matters, and I turned away and wanted to go back. She followed me screaming, and I shot her in the head. I did not look at her and do not remember whether I shot her more than once. Immediately afterwards, I went to the depot and took a train for home. It was dark. On the way home on the train, I threw the revolver out of the car window. I want to state that I didn't kill Anna Luther for her money, as the newspapers have stated. My original reason for marrying Anna is that I did not care to live with my first wife any longer. But as she had given me a child, my desire to again see my child caused me to want to get rid of Anna Luther and return to my first wife and child. This is the reason why I shot Anna Luther. And I told her in Bayshore that I was married and had a wife and child and must leave her. She screamed and ran after me and kissed me and wanted me back, and I shot her. This confession is made of my own free will without any hope of recompense being offered to me." Police have been able to find him by tracing two police dogs he brought from Germany, but in reality, it was a stroke of good luck for the police and bad luck for the fugitive. A newspaper photographer using a flash from photographing the dogs, the flare revealed the pale face of Gebhardt peering from the chinks of an outhouse. He was run down and arrested. In November 1909, Warden Fury of the county jail received an anonymous letter written in Germany. In German, the letter declared that Gebhardt's real name was Fritz Schaeferlein. The writer declared that on September 15, 1895, Schaeferling married a woman whose name was not given. He sailed from Germany with her on the steamer Kensington. He got all her money and then deserted her. If this was true or not, it wasn't proven. Murder was a more serious affair than desertion, and the DA poured their efforts into proving the case against him. By October 1910, Gebhardt was convicted of murdering Anna Luther and was sentenced to death the week of December 5th. On June 12, 1911, after losing his appeals, Frederick Gebhardt was executed at Sing Sing's electric chair. Anna was buried on June 26, 1911 in Oakwood Cemetery. The DA had kept her remains until after Gebhardt's execution. Aside from the undertaker and his assistant, the only other person present at the burial was Henry Werpup. There was no ceremony of any kind. She was buried on her 30th birthday. Originally, her remains were to be cremated and sent to her family in Germany, but they decided to bury her in the United States instead. Mr. Werpup was to keep her belongings until her father could come the following year from Germany to pick them up. So, there you go. And the truth is, at this point, they used this last name that of Gebhardt, but in reality, that might not even have been his real name. And this goes back to what this was over 100 years ago, how easy it was, especially if you were coming from another country, to change your name. And it's not like now where everything is tracked. You could. And it's like, and where what was his birth name? Nobody, I think, ever really knew what that was. But there you go. He was a psychopath, but he wanted to see his kid. Kind of weird. All right. This next story is out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, and it's titled The Mirror in Suite 72. Now, again, this is a murder mystery in a way, because what you're and the reason why some of these I think that are so interesting is because even though they happened obviously many, many, many years ago, these people were still doing what we see nowadays, which is basically doing away with each other's over always the same things. Money, love, revenge. And in some cases, you see where there's not any type of, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. There's no, how can I say? There's no horrible, like, you did this horrible thing to me, betrayed me, you know, you cheated on me, you took my, all the things, people were murdering even back then just for the sake of murdering and of greed, of course. Now, again, this other story is The Mirror in Suite 72. And it starts off on October 24th, 1905. Mary Jane Cayley was staying in Suite 72 at the Aberdeen Hotel, the same one she had rented several times in the past. That day, she had already bought her ticket to return by train to her hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. Then, for some unfathomable reason, she shot herself in the temple. Why would a wealthy 21-year-old woman do this? The place is Manhattan, New York, 1901. Penn State was under construction and Macy's had opened on 34th Street. Around the corner from Tiffany B. Altman and the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, plans were underway to build a new Beaux-Art hotel, a style called apartment hotels, which were the latest thing for out-of-towners who needed a pied-à-terre without the need to hire servants or worry about maintenance. Residents dining in a communal dining room or restaurant and hotel staff catered to their needs. In September 1904, the Aberdeen, a 12-story brick and limestone structure, opened its doors. Like all places that welcome strangers who bring their love stories, hopes, and woes, scandal would soon visit the new hotel. It came in the form of Mary Jane Cayley. She was the daughter of Thomas and Mary Cayley. However, by the time Mary paid her visit to the Aberdeen, her mother was married to George Walker, and the prosperous family lived in Ohio. The body was found by Mrs. Allen, who lived in the suite next to Mary. She would accompany Mary on trips to Ladies' Mile Shopping, which was close by. The dead woman was fully dressed, and it seemed she had stood in front of the mirror when she was shot. The revolver lay beside her on the floor. Two cartridges had been freshly discharged, but only one bullet could be found. On a table in her room was a length gold purse studded with diamonds and rubies, and the contents included $133. There was a number of rings, a heart-shaped pin set with diamonds, a large pin set with diamonds, and two bar pins studded with diamonds. She had bought several furs, which were already packed. Most of her toiletries were monogrammed with her initials. There was also a package of letters tied with a white ribbon. There was one envelope addressed, "For Lillian, care of Mrs. G. Allen. Give to Jack. Don't mention names." Inside the envelope was a letter which read, "Tired, tired, forgive me, darling sister. Love me, May." The Lillian referred to on the suicide note was believed to be Lillian Castle, a.k.a. Lillian Landes, of Tarrytown. Mrs. Allen had met her through Mary, who referred to her as Lillian, my half-sister. Even though Mary Cayley's death appeared to be strictly a suicide, there was enough questions asked that inevitably her dirty laundry was aired, especially when her mother said she was sure there was foul play involved. First, there was some mystery as to how long Mary had been staying at the Aberdeen when she was killed. The authorities were trying to retrace her whereabouts, and it was determined that in the spring of 1905, she spent 2 months at the Hamilton Hotel at West 45th Street. Supposedly, she had returned to Cleveland afterward. However, no one could verify how long she had been staying at the Aberdeen this last time. The management said she had been there no more than 4 days, but at a Bureau for Nurses in West 21st Street, they stated that a trained nurse had been to her room at the Aberdeen on September 16. In between her active social life, Mary visited her wealthy Uncle Nelson, who lived on 32nd Street in New York, and she was a regular attendant at John D. Rockefeller's church. She was no stranger to the city. To add to the gossip, it seemed that Mary Jane Cayley led a sensational life before her death. Since she was 16, she traveled from coast to coast, associating with prominent men of the country, and always had jewels and plenty of money. In New York, she was well acquainted with important men in baseball and sporting circles, where Ralph Pitzer ran a saloon, which might explain how she eventually became his wife. During the Pan American Exposition held in Buffalo in 1901, a reputed marriage occurred between her and Ralph Pitzer. According to Pitzer, it was a result of a bet in which the wife of a prominent Boston rubber man and the sister of a well-known actress who were members of the party propositioned that Pitzer marry Miss Cayley. He said he refused, and at the instigation of other members of the party, a supposed justice of the peace was sent for to perform the ceremony. Pitzer said he never lived with her, and even though they stayed at the Iroquois Hotel for several days, they occupied separate rooms. He said he led a roving life traveling from New York to San Francisco. He denied seeing her again after he left Buffalo, and she made no claim against his name. However, this story later proved to be false, since Mary had visited Youngstown, Ohio twice, and both times met with him. Whether they were truly married or not, they mostly led separate lives. 4 years later, there was another man in Mary Cayley's life. Among her papers, there was a letter addressed to Mary from a man who used the stationery of the New York Athletic Club and signed with the name Jack. Mrs. Allen said that Jack had introduced himself to Mary Cayley one day as they were in the elevator. The love letter was 2 or 3 months old. Jack wrote that his yacht was anchored at the foot of 34th Street on the East River and that he would soon set off for Halifax. He would not be back until September 5th. He apologized for being away so soon. He wrote, quote, "The widows and things you speak of don't exist for me. I am the only single man on board, but the others are grass widowers, temporarily. I love you, pet, more than anything else in the world," end quote. 3 weeks before her death, Mary Cayley had moved into a boarding house owned by Mrs. E.S. Waller at 245 Sibley Street, Cleveland. She planned to train as a nurse at the Lakeside Hospital School. Mrs. Waller said that on October 12th, a well-dressed man who registered at the Colonial Hotel in the city visited with Mary Cayley at her home. He drove a red automobile and was tall and broad-shouldered. The two were together all evening, then he went away. According to Mrs. Waller, the young woman departed the next day. The man was supposed to be a traveling salesman from New York. Mrs. Waller and her two daughters met Mary Cayley at a summer resort at North Madison the summer of 1905. Mrs. Waller said, "She always had plenty of money. I can only think that she was jilted by the man who called on her 10 days ago. Who the man was, I do not know. He was her only caller in the 3 weeks that she was at my house. One of the hotel clerks at the Aberdeen said that on one occasion he asked one of Mary Kayleigh's male visitors for his full name in order to announce him, and he said, "Mr. McKelvain wants to see Miss Kayleigh." It was reported that he took a writing nearly every day. Was Jack McKelvain his real name? A check with the New York Athletic Club found no member with that name. The coroner disclosed that a short time before her suicide, Mary Kayleigh had received a message which had been telephoned to the hotel. It stated that the sender, a man, was sorry, but he couldn't see her. The question remained if this is what drove her to take her life. Mrs. Clark believed her daughter was a victim of foul play. A month after Mary's death, she engaged Arthur Sharp, a real estate dealer, to go and reopen the case. He was tasked to obtain the letter her daughter wrote to Jack, which somehow had mysteriously disappeared. She said that her daughter had more money than what was found at the scene of her death. She said, "I can never believe that my daughter took her own life. She had made all preparations to come here to Ohio. Someone murdered her, and I shall not stop until he is punished." She said that Mary expected to marry Jack as soon as she could get a divorce from Frank Pitzer. The separation had taken place because Mary claimed her husband had another favorite, and that she was afraid of the woman for whom Pitzer showed the most love. She said this woman had threatened to kill her. Had Mary lied to her mother about the validity of her marriage? Could that explain why she never took the surname of Pitzer? Nothing further was published about Mary Jane Kayleigh, not even details about her burial. What came of Arthur Sharp's investigation also remained a mystery. Was it because he didn't find anything? Or perhaps what he found was so damaging, it was preferable to leave Mary's cause of death as a suicide. Was she killed because of an inconvenient love affair? Or was robbery the reason? In March 1906, an inventory was made of Mary Kayleigh's estate. It was appraised at $814.45, made up of money, diamonds, jewelry, and clothing. This is equivalent to $26,000 present day. In 1912, the Aberdeen was sold, and the large suites were broken down into smaller apartments for the use of transient guests. Suite 72, where Mary Kayleigh died standing in front of a mirror, was no more. So again, did Mary Kayleigh take her life? Or was there something nefarious going on? And you think about it, and this girl sounds like, well, if she's traveling from coast to coast at the age of 16 and keeping company with what sounds like a fast crowd, people, wealthy people with fast crowd, and it seems like this girl, who knows what kind of lifestyle she was leading. Because remember, back in these days, 16-year-old girls did not go around the country in the jet set, especially if you were unmarried. So that she looked like maybe she might have gotten herself into trouble, and I don't know. There's a lot of empty holes in that. And then the fact that you can find there was no obituary printed about her death, nothing about her burial, nothing ever came of the investigation that her mom hired someone to do. That's all very strange, which usually indicates that whatever was dug up was not favorable towards her. So there you go. Next story is out of Daily Mail, and this is titled CERN to Test World's Most Powerful Particle Accelerator During April Solar Eclipse to Search for Invisible Matter That Secretly Powers Our Universe. I wonder why they chose April 8th. I don't know. Let me see. The world's largest and most powerful particle accelerator is set to smash protons together on April 8th to search for invisible particles secretly powering our universe. Theories have suggested there are 17 different particle groups, and the European Organization for Nuclear Research, better known as CERN, confirmed the existence of one using its Large Hadron Collider in 2012. Now the team has restarted the LHC with hopes of unraveling more mysteries of the universe, specifically dark matter. Scientists began preliminary tests by sending billions of protons around the LHC's ring of superconducting magnets to boost their energy and ensure the $4 billion machine was in working condition. And next month, CERN will shoot them down a 17-mile-long tunnel at nearly the speed of light to create conditions a second after the Big Bang. The LHC will continue the experiment until later this year, when it will then be put under a long hibernation for CERN to transform it into the next version, the High Luminosity, or LHC. The accelerator sits 300 feet underground at the border of France and Switzerland and first went live on September 10, 2008. The LHC works by smashing protons together to break them apart and discover the subatomic particles that exist inside them and how they interact. Scientists turned on the powerful machine this month, injecting it with several proton beams. CERN researchers use protons due to them being heavier particles. The weight allows much lower energy loss per turn through the accelerator than other particles like photon. On March 8th, teams from around the world waited inside the underground lab for a glimpse at the beams of circling inside the ring of the LHC. The circular shape was by design as it allows for more time to accelerate the beam of particles so higher energy can be reached. But the first attempt this month did not go as planned after the beam only made it partially around. But this month's experiments prove the beam trajectory was off as it did complete a full circle. But after tinkering with the mechanics, the team watched in wonder as the beam circled the accelerator in less than 20 minutes. At full power, trillions of protons will race around the LHC accelerator ring 11,245 times a second and travel just 7 miles per hour, less than the speed of light. On April 8th, the team will send the beams through the tunnel where they will collide. The team will be on the hunt for dark matter, which makes up about 28% of our massive universe, but it has never been seen or proven. This work will give them insights into the formation of the universe and even its ultimate fate. The experiment is scheduled to occur the same day as the Great North American Solar Eclipse. The total solar occurs when the moon completely blocks the face of the sun, briefly turning the outdoors dark during the daytime. The spectacle will be visible to an estimated 32 million people along a narrow path through North and Central America. It will mark the first total eclipse. Solar eclipse will be seen in the U.S. since August of 2017. The purpose of the LHC is to let scientists test predictions of different particle physics, including measuring the properties of the Higgs boson, or God particle, which was a missing piece in the jigsaw for physicists and trying to understand how the universe works. Scientists believe that a fraction of a second after the Big Bang that gave birth to the universe, an invisible energy field called the Higgs field formed. As particles passed through the field, they picked up mass, giving them size and shape and allowing them to form the atoms that make up you. Everything around you, excuse me, excuse me, and everything in the universe. This was the theory proposed in 1964 by former grammar school boy Professor Higgs that has now been confirmed. And while the particles near instantly decayed during the LHC experiment, scientists found they left a footprint behind, revealing their existence. The LHC is typically used just 1 month each year, but has been shut down over long periods for upgrades. It was last turned off in 2022 in Europe's amid Europe's energy crisis. Firing up the LHC is a complex process requiring everything to work like an orchestra. Ren Steenbergen, excuse me, in charge of control room operations at CERN in Switzerland, said in 2022. This comes with a certain sense of tension, nervousness, he explained, adding that a lot can go wrong, including obstructions in the tunnel and issues with magnets. I have a feeling there's more than that can go wrong. I mean, I'm not a physicist, but excuse me. But when you're trying to, I don't know. Why choose that date of all the dates? Well, let's go on to our next story. And we're going to go back to Stranger Than Fiction stories. And this story is titled The Lonely Ghost at St. Michael's Orphanage. And the Belvedere Orphanage in Newfoundland was slated for demolition after it was damaged by fire in April 2017. The question is, what happens to the spirits that are said to haunt this centuries-old orphanage, school, and convent when it is repurposed as an apartment building? Newfoundland, Canada. Hugh Alexander Emerson, a politician, built a second empire-style house in 1826. When Emerson's wife died in the 1840s, he sold it to Bishop Michael Anthony Fleming. The bishop died within its walls, but he is not one of its purported ghosts. This house became part of the group of buildings that would include the Belvedere Orphanage. St. Michael's Convent, which housed the Sisters of Mercy, was converted into a girls' orphanage in 1826. Within 30 years, a new building named the Belvedere Orphanage, also known as St. Michael's Orphanage, was constructed to accept all the foundlings brought to its doors. About 200 girls lived in the orphanage during the 1950s, but the numbers dwindled until they closed in 1969. The building was then used as a schoolhouse, offices, and a home for the local Catholic newspaper. In 1989, allegations of abuse at the orphanage surfaced. One of the girls, now an adult, described how in the 1950s she, along with her older sister, were placed there by her father after her mother died. She was 4 and her sister was 10 years old. The orphanage was their home for the next 8 years. She said she was hit so hard that it raised welts, and she saw nuns slap girls and swing them by their hair. Excuse me. The woman said she had never seen any sexual abuse by the nuns, but she did watch older girls make advances to younger ones. Social workers never visited, and police would return any runaways. She was able to leave when she was 12 to live with her father and her stepmother. She, along with her sister and other prior inmates, sued the Sisters of Mercy in 1996. By 2010, more than 30 women were suing the Congregation of the Sisters of Mercy and the province of Newfoundland. The case was 13 years old then, and many of the nuns had died, and memories of those alive were fading. The order abandoned the building in 1999, and it became derelict. For years, there were stories about a ghost witness, mostly during the 1970s when it functioned as a school. The one time Sister Michael, who served as the principal for Belvedere Junior High School from 1971 to 1976 when it closed, lived in the convent portion of the building during those years. She described hearing strange sounds she couldn't explain. It was the sound of someone walking, always on the top floor of the building. She never had the courage to investigate. The janitor told her he had doors open after he had closed them. A visit from a paranormal expert with the Memorial University described the ghost as a poltergeist, which are usually connected to teenage girls. On another occasion, two women from Argentina stayed at the school. One woman told Sister Michael that from the moment she arrived at the property, she was in touch with the suffering of young girls, especially with a particular spirit. On another occasion, the superintendent arrived at the school to find a secretary in the parking lot waiting for him. She said she refused to be alone in the building after she heard footsteps down the main hallway when no one was there. Behind the convent, there's a single tree known as the shade tree. Curiously placed and super old, is the subject of plenty of folklore, but exactly what that is unknown. In November 2023, a zoning change for the land where St. Michael's Convent and the Belvedere Orphanage operated from was submitted, which would allow the erection of a 60-unit building. The oldest structure would be demolished. The orphanage building was razed after it caught fire in 2017. And two questions remain. Who is it that has been heard pacing along the fourth floor corridor? And will it she finally be set free or continue either seeking revenge or redemption in a place that it is no more? So yeah. It's very sad to think of some of the things that took place there. Now, this next story, also out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, is titled The Wicked Stepmother. Mary Hoag's slashed body was found stuffed in a steamer trunk, and the suspect was none other than her stepson. Jacob Hoag, 48, a baggage manager for the Pennsylvania Railroad, told police that his son, Joseph, 21, sat on a steamer trunk while waiting for an express man to remove it. He thought it was odd, but not as odd as the fact that he couldn't find his wife. He'd only been married 10 months, and he hurried home from work like the newlywed he was. His first wife, Sarah, mother of his children, had died in 1929. When Jacob Hoag found droplets of blood in his home, his suspicions were raised, and he pushed his son out of the way. Inside the trunk, he found his 30-year-old bride doubled over inside. Her face and chest were slashed, and she had a hole in the base of her skull. When he turned to ask his son what happened, Joseph had disappeared. When police arrived at 5325 Parrish Street, Philadelphia, they found an ice pick and chisel stained with blood in the cellar. In the adjacent yard, they found bloodstained clothes and a burlap bag which turned out to belong to Joseph Hogue. At first, the newspapers ran with a story that this tragic result was a tragic result of a love triangle between Mary Brogan Hogue, her stepson, and her husband. Joe Hogan was the eldest of five children, and the rumor was that they had kept company before and that Jacob Hogue had wooed Mary away from his own son. However, Mary Hogue's sister, Grace Neeson, said there was nothing between her sister and Joseph Hogue, and they had met once 3 years before. Then he enlisted in the military, and she had not seen him again until after she was married to his father. Jacob Hogue contradicted this story and said that Joseph had asked Mrs. Hogue for money on several occasions, and when she refused him, he became angry. At the coroner's inquest, Jacob Hogue said that his son killed Mary Hogue because she spurned him when he proposed that they elope together. He told police his son and wife had been involved 3 years before, but she broke it off when he enlisted in the Marine Corps. The following day, after the body was found, Mr. Hogue found that $22 in rent money his wife had hidden was missing, along with her white pocketbook, where she kept more money and the keys. The coroner found $87 sewn into the pocket of the dead woman's clothing. Hogue had been discharged from the Marine Corps 3 weeks before the murder. 2 weeks after the crime, Joseph Hogue was arrested in Washington, D.C., near his old army haunts at the Central Mission, where he worked with an assumed name in the boiler room. Upon his arrest, he confessed he killed his stepmother because she beat my kid's sister. Within a day, he recanted on the confession. Joseph Hogue was held without bail. Jacob Hogue did not appear at his son's arraignment. However, his other children had a different story to tell about their stepmother. His sister Mary, 20, told reporters, "I'm glad she's dead, and if my brother killed her, I'll stand by him." John Hogue, another sibling, said, "My stepmother was a real devil. She was mean. She used to keep bacon and sugar in her bedroom, and at mealtimes she'd bring down a couple of lumps of sugar for herself." Mary Hogue described where her stepmother was a veritable monster. She said, "Our stepmother never gave us enough to eat. She kept good things for herself. My brother Joe was not home when father married her a year ago. He was in the service, but he met our stepmother when he came home on leave. Father took him out one night to the home of some friends, and there Joe met her. She seemed to like Joe. She made such a fuss over him. She tried to sit on his lap. She said to Joe, 'If I was a little younger, I'd marry you.' Joe kidded about it when he came home. Then he went back at the end of his leave, and father got married. Our stepmother didn't love my father. She just made a fool of him and kept saving money to go back to Ireland. He was afraid of her, too." Mary Hogue, who was 10 years old, corroborated the story, complaining that her stepmother had beat her unmercifully several times. Mrs. Augustus Magnus, a neighbor whom Mary lived with, said, "I feel terrible because I didn't report Mrs. Hogue's treatment of her stepchildren to the police long ago. They used to come to me looking starved, and I would give them meals." During the trial, Joe Hogue described what happened the day Mary Hogue was killed. At about the dinner hour, they argued over her ill treatment of his 11-year-old sister. He struck her and rendered her unconscious. Fearing the consequences of having hit her, he killed her with a chisel and stuffed the body into the trunk. On September 6, 1934, Joseph Martin Hogue was sentenced to life imprisonment at Eastern State Penitentiary after having pled guilty to murder in the first degree. By 1940, he was an inmate at the Fairview State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. He was still there in 1950, and he died in 1961 at the age of 48. His father, Jacob, died in 1958. Was Joe Hogue a cold-blooded killer who murdered his stepmother or being spurned and to steal money? Or was it an argument that escalated when a young man defended his siblings, especially a young sister that was being abused? Was it true that even Jacob Hogue feared his new wife, so much so he couldn't safeguard his own children? Did she get her just desserts for being a greedy, wicked stepmother? So what do you think? I have a feeling after reading this, I do think that. I think this lady was abusing those kids, and the older brother came home and got really mad, and it got out of hand, and next thing you know, oops, I killed my stepmother. And there you go. That was the end of his normal life. Next story, also out of Stranger Than Fiction stories, is called Folklore and Rituals of the Dutch County. There's a ritual tradition that spans 3 centuries, practiced by Dutch settlers in Pennsylvania, known as hexerei, witchcraft of evil intent, and brokkery. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, so casting of spells with intent to do good and faith in powwow doctors. There are those who argue that rituals can both heal and harm. Brokkerij, a healing method called powwow by the Pennsylvania Dutch, is passed mostly through oral tradition, and it addresses health problems for humans and livestock. But it's not only healing, there's protection and benedictions and prayers to ensure a positive outcome for everyday life. Christian symbols are intertwined within the practice. In 1882, an alleged case of witchcraft was reported in Lehigh County, Pennsylvania. In the fall of 1881, a newly married young man who lived a little Lehigh suffered involuntary muscular movements compared to St. Vitus dance. During his convulsions, he would act queerly, and it was asserted he was acting under the evil influence of a witch. The witch in question was a beautiful young woman who lived in the township. She was called Hex, and the neighbors around where the woman lived would not even let their children outdoor unless they were guarding them. There was a demand for horseshoes, which were nailed over the entrance doors to dwellings, since it was believed they had the power to cast off all danger to person and property. The populace became so terrorized, some refused to venture outdoors after nightfall. The outcome of the strange case is unknown. In 1895, a young woman who lived in Albertus claimed she was suffering from fur hexerei. She said that whenever she would go outdoors after nightfall, something resembling a large, big black cat followed her. She took her younger brother along to see whether he could see the cat, and he said the strange apparition followed in their footsteps. She experienced this horrible scene for a few months. Once she had found that during the night her dresses had been torn to shreds, she said the hex, German for witch, did it. She believed the witch resided in the neighborhood. She got better, but then the old hex revisited her and was uncomfortably rampant in her evil doings, diabolical in her transactions, and quite mysterious in her way. One of the specters was as large as a mule, or so she said. If she went to bed, the spirit followed her, tore the bedclothes off of her, hopped on the bed, under the bed, and all around her. She came under the care of a hexadoctor, who ordered her to go away from home for a period of 9 days in order to counteract the witch's power. She moved in with her fiancé's family, and there were no more visitations. However, when she returned, the black cat came back and was always at her heels. The animal was said to be fence high and with a tail as long as a fence rail, but seemingly endless. It would appear after nightfall and disappear at midnight. That same year, it was reported that there were witches living in the Blue Mountains of Pennsylvania. It described where many households had in their possession witchcraft books over a century old. They're hidden away in chests or secure corners and kept secret only to be used when an emergency arose. All of the spirit reprints of the old German books were printed secretly in Germany as early as 1750. It was learned that Hebrew peddlers who ventured into the wilds of the Blue Mountains from New York 100 years before brought these books with them and secretly sold them. To be in possession of such books in the old country meant death or imprisonment. The recollection of what happened to witches in New England led the backwoods people to secret the books away. There was a stalwart, bush-headed man, 65 or 70 years of age, who lived in Reading, who was known as the hexadoctor, and would be summoned to treat nervous afflictions and spells. He would not practice his art with any witness except the patient. But it wasn't only nervous twitches that indicated the person had been bewitched. If a young woman, soon to be married, forgot to do the milking on time, burned a dinner, put too much bluing in the wash, broke eggs or plates, forgot to feed the dog or the hogs, tore any wearing apparel, or lost anything, she had surely a spell cast upon her. The witch doctor would only be sent for if the case was urgent and the bewitched person was in danger of going mad. According to the witch doctor, 9 times out of 10, the witch was a neighbor or an old woman. During modern times, many are not familiar with the practice of powwowing, much less believe that it was still in use. In reality, those who still practice it or seek remedies have gone underground for fear of being called crazy or Dutchy. Among conservative Mennonites, the practice is considered to be the work of Satan. However, there are still powwowers in Pennsylvania who are open about their identity, who plan to pass on their knowledge to younger family members through oral tradition. This is how they learned themselves. The knowledge is passed from one man to woman and woman to man, cross-gender transmission. There are some diaries and notebooks with recipes, but these are few and far between. Their clients themselves usually come through word of mouth. The main source of origins of the rituals are the Bible, which is used as evidence by the power that they work with God and not the devil, and why they do not request payment for their services. An effective verse appears in the King James Bible, which is often referred to. And when I passed by thee and saw thee polluted in thine own blood, I said unto thee, when thou waste in thy blood, live. Yea, I said unto thee, when thou waste in thy blood, live. Ezekiel. The next source is the long lost friend, which is in the original German, was written by John George Hohmann in 1919. Hohmann, a German occultist, immigrated in 1802, who borrowed information from the German charm book, Romanus. He also used Magnus's Egyptian secrets. He said possessing the book itself acted as an amulet. Also, destroying a copy could be used to lift a hex, which figured in the 1929 murder of Powwower Nelson Ray Meyer in New York County. Most of these texts are derived from European magical traditions. A problematic text that was used is the sixth and seventh book of Moses because of its association with black magic and conjuring spirits. It is considered a hex book. There's also the eighth and ninth books of Moses, which is geared towards ceremonial magic with depictions of circles, seals, incantation, etc., sourced from the Kabbalah, the Key of Solomon, and other ancient texts. The incantations use the mystical names of God, demons, celestial bodies, and archangels with English, Latin, Greek, Hebrew words, and some Egyptian hieroglyphs. A 16-page chapbook was published in 1938 and authored by William Wilson Basil. It is a collection of charms or spells known as sympathies, which referred to events in the life of Jesus. The most important content mentioned by the author was the Himmelsbrief, Holy Fire and Pestilence letter, to protect from illness and fire. The content was a translation from the work of Dr. G.F. Helfenstein's Tried and Tested Household Treasure of Sympathy or Magical Powers and Secrets of Nature Revealed. It was published in 1853 along with The Long Hidden Friend. Possession of the book was supposed to act as an amulet. Many of the traditions are tied to the healing powers of Catholic saints, a belief that was driven underground by the Reformation. Now, yeah, because remember, during the schism in Germany, when Protestantism came about because of Martin Luther, and there was a very big conflict between Catholicism and Protestantism, yeah, people got killed over that stuff. So, anyway, and there you go. That is going to be it for this version, this latest version of Eerie News. And then believe me, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. Let's see what happens on April 8th, Eclipse Day. Hopefully, nothing like any other eclipse, but we'll find out soon. So, till next time, take care.